Make It Right, the manufacturing podcast.
Over the last 3 months, Make It Right podcast guests have generously shared their challenges, learnings, and insights from everything from health and safety on the factory floor to the evolving supply chain, journeys to world class, and more. I'm Janet Eastman, and this week on the show, we look back at the summer of 2019 with a few highlights from a few of our shows, just in case you missed them through the holiday months. We'll take a look at disruptive innovation, how to find and establish a second-in-command based on one man's journey, and how to sell to your customers. In early June, Todd Hockenberry was my guest. He works with B2B manufacturing, technology, and capital equipment companies to help them achieve top-line revenue growth. He shared some key tips on how to prove you are truly customer-focused, and he started out by explaining how buyer expectations have changed.
Obviously, the internet's certainly the thing that's changed how people buy virtually everything, right? And I usually just pull my phone out of my pocket and show it to people and say, think about how everything you essentially buy has changed. And you know, clearly we see that with the Amazon effect, right? Where you're used to having this very personalized experience where there's very strong recommendations based on your behavior and your likes and your previous purchasing patterns. And there's a really easy to use interface and the transaction's simple and fast and it's kind of fun and helpful, right? So these ideas, this kind of Amazon effect, which we all know is really changing how people feel about all the purchases, whether they're in it's a personal one or a B2B purchase, right? We see this in virtually every industry we've worked in. And I actually think that's more of kind of a 10 to 15 year change. I actually think in the last year or two, it's actually accelerated. I think that what we're seeing is that people's busyness and time and expectations in terms of how they purchase virtually anything, whether it's large capital equipment purchases, services, software, you name it, our expectations have just gone through the roof in terms of ease of use, the kind of experience we want, the expectations of how to communicate with a company and connect with them. We want to buy from people that understand us and that create this experience. It's a differentiator, right? Ultimately, I believe B2B buyers want the companies they buy from to have the company's sales process be a competitive differentiator. Buyers want to work with companies that have a sales process that's easy. For example, the old days, the sales training was oftentimes, salespeople would be trained on discovery and needs identification, and they would be trained to ask lots of questions, right? Well, the executives that I talk to and the buyers that I talk to, they don't want me to be on the call asking them a bunch of questions about their business. They expect that I already know it, that I know their business, that I know their issues, and I'm bringing expertise to the table to say to them, here's what you need to do. Here's opportunities for you to grow. Here's opportunities to solve these problems that maybe you didn't think of. I deal a lot with inbound marketing and digital marketing and helping B2B companies kind of reimagine that. And they don't expect me to come in and ask them how they're doing that. They expect me to come in knowing what to do and coming in with recommendations. So I think people's expectations of the people they buy from have just gone through the roof. And I don't blame them, because the reality is most of the information that previous generations of salespeople and marketing people could find out is all available to them if they just do it, right? People don't want to be sold to by lazy salespeople. They want people that are professionals, that are peers, that understand their business and can come in and hit the ground running and push them in a direction maybe they didn't think they wanted to go. So we talk a lot about people want to be helped and educated. They don't really want to be sold. So this is why we talk a lot about culture and your mindset and your mission, because if you're not creating a business that's focused on educating and helping first, then you're going to struggle with the modern buyer.
So how are you making that initial contact then to that customer? You're not waiting for them to come around. So how do you make that? How do you start that relationship then?
Yeah, I think there's a misnomer a little bit about relationship selling. And I think the issue is the relationship is not first, the relationship comes later. So the reality is roughly something like 97 or 96% of B2B sales start with an online search. There's all kinds of data around that. I don't think that's even controversial anymore. That's natural. We understand that. We do that. We all do that. So the question is, what do people find when they search? Do they even find you? And if they do, what do they find? Have you thought it through and used your marketing and your website space, your digital footprint to help people and to educate and to share relevant information? Or are you just talking about your product? Are you talking about you? Is your website all a bunch of pictures of your equipment or your machines or your factory floor? Or is it about the problems you solve and your customers? So most sales are going to start with some type of search. But we also work with our clients to help them use kind of modern inbound ideas to actually make outbound calls. So cold calling, while I would never do a real straight up cold call, I would always recommend a warm call. If you know your audience and you know how you help them and you know you can improve their business, then you have an obligation almost to focus, reach out, and connect with those people that can use your help the most. It's not a spray and pray or just a dialing for dollars kind of thing. We're talking about using all of your marketing to kind of educate, help, and connect. And salespeople are really important to that in terms of building the relationship. Once you connect with somebody online or you connect with them on LinkedIn, you have an opportunity to start helping them. So you're not going to build that relationship up front. I believe that the relationship comes after you've shared value and after you've helped people. It's not that you're going to share stories about playing golf together, or going fishing, and all of a sudden they're going to buy from you. No, the people aren't going to waste time on that. What they're going to do is they're going to look and see if you've actually helped them, if you've given them new context to their problems, have you brought them helpful information, tools, research, ideas that can help them move their process, their business, their strategies forward. And if you do that, you then earn the right to sell to them. And if you do sell, then you have to keep doing it, right? You have to create a great experience where you make things easy for them, save them time, and then you can start migrating and moving into higher levels of value, like improving their business and helping them execute better and helping them build differentiation. And then ultimately, if you can help them drive their business growth and their internal improvements that help make them a better company, that help them attract more people, now you've reached kind of the highest level of value. And as you do that, you build a relationship. The relationship to me comes after, it doesn't come before. And unless you bring value and you bring something unique to the table, you don't even get a chance to build a relationship.
Yeah. Okay. So we are all individuals, and the very first thing in our head is always to talk about us. So when you're a manufacturer or whatever, the whole thing is we got to talk about how great we are so people understand it and they want to do business with us. We all know that doesn't work because the guy on the other end of the phone or who's looking at your website doesn't care about you. They care about them and they want to know that you're answering their needs. So what do you tell a manufacturer to put on their website so they do get that attention of a possible customer?
Yeah, well, one of the first things companies will almost always say, and executives will almost always say to me, well, we prioritize the customer. That's what we're focused on, right? We're all customer oriented. It's kind of almost a cliche or kind of a no-brainer. Of course we do that. And then we look at their websites, like you said, and you realize that this is all about them. They're talking about their product. They're listing the industries they serve. They're showing equipment, right? It's very spec and product focused. And the reality is what should be there is really the outcomes that you deliver, the outcomes your equipment brings or your service brings or whatever it is, and really what they get out of it, right? So you need to understand who that person is that's potentially could use your solution. So that's what we call a persona, which is understanding kind of the individual person who is looking for your help and how you help them. And then also partly about how they buy, right? So you're going to know whether it's a short-term purchase or it's a long-term purchase that requires budgeting. You're going to understand if there's a lot of other groups involved, whether you need to bring in operations or you need to bring in the IT team, right? All these things are going to be reflected in your marketing, because your marketing is going to be about how you help them and how you deliver benefits and value to them and how you make their life easier, right? So it's could be even about your sales process, right? It could be about how you help them go through these steps faster. We had a client once that made gearboxes for small electronic equipment. It was a very kind of niche component business. And we work with them to try to understand their unique value and their differentiation. And what we found was that it wasn't about technology and it wasn't about product, even though the products were very good. What the differentiation was they had figured out how to make prototypes very quickly. And why that was important was that companies that were trying to bring their products to market needed to go through the prototyping stage, and it was oftentimes very lengthy. There was tooling involved, designs, and what they had my client had figured out how to do was to compress that cycle and do it very inexpensively and quickly. So that's what they promoted on their website and their marketing, that they could help not just make prototypes quickly, but the outcomes of that. The outcomes of that was that their clients could go to market faster. They could reduce the costs in the product development cycles. They could reduce the errors and potential delays that impacted an entire supply chain. So they brought value that was different than the product, that had to do with the journey and the experience their customer went on. And that's what they focused on. And if you don't, as a company, figure those types of things out, then what happens is you have no choice but to fall back on your product and tell everybody how great you are. And the reality is, folks, you're probably not that great when it comes to product and service. Differentiation on those levels is really hard to find. And it's really hard to do. In most industries, there's a lot of competition, and good quality, good service, good delivery are kind of table stakes, and you're not even in business unless you can do that. So the reality is people aren't anywhere near as customer focused as they should be. And I would just challenge people to say, look at the interactions you have in your daily life with people you're buying from and companies you're interacting with. Do you really feel like they're putting you first? I don't feel that very often.
That's Todd Hockenberry. He's the owner of Top Line Results, a company that helps B2B companies understand their ideal target audience, create amazing customer experiences, and grow. You can hear the full interview on episode 58 of the Make It Right podcast. Finding and establishing a second in command is not easy, particularly for a third generation family-owned business. In July, my guest was CEO Tom Marini, who shared his trials, tribulations, and ultimate success in a journey working to find someone to be his right-hand person while he pushed to grow Marini Manufacturing.
As the company grew and I did things, we created different areas or departments, and we had different people doing different functions and different roles. But ultimately, I think I still, and however, maybe because we started so small or that was the structure, a lot of decisions or authority still came back to me. So, you know, while there was shipping and receiving, quality, manufacturing, design, all these different groups working, if there was any competing thoughts or ideas, or there was a difference in opinion, I'd have to make a decision. And that became, one, it was just hard to do it in a timely basis, in a real-time basis, when I was traveling a little bit more for work, more involved in the office. So I wanted to step outside, step off the shop floor, or try to have someone who could make some ultimate decisions other than me. We had a lot of people there working, doing things. It's when ideas would compete. You know, if design came up with a fixture design to make these parts and manufacturing didn't like it, well, either no resolution or I'd have to get involved and make a decision. And I wanted someone to start being able to make those decisions for me. I think it was that. Also, I'd been with the company probably 20 years, and I kind of remembered what I was able to do for my dad and by taking on more responsibility of doing that. So I was looking for a version of me coming up behind me. And I knew it wouldn't be family member because I have young children, but they're nowhere near ready to be involved. So I knew I had to kind of grow and develop someone. If I find what I offered my dad, I'd have to find that person to help me out. And I was looking for that as well.
Right. And I guess based on your situation, you've got a company of 30 or 40 people. It's probably easy, or well, whether it's easy or best or whatever, it's to try and find that person that's actually inside your company rather than looking outside, right?
Yes. I had to learn the hard way. You know, I wish I could. I did probably a year or two, a couple of years prior to me. I probably made the decision that I knew I needed to find somebody, but I looked to the outside, and that was, and I mentioned that in the article, and we haven't talked about it yet, but I would hire, you know, I'd put a, you know, somebody, a resume would come across my desk, or someone would make a suggestion for an individual. And it was, they were high, you know, they had great success elsewhere. They were plant managers, general managers, all these different things. And so I looked to the outside first, and that was probably some of them, I was not probably doing it the exact right way. And you'd hire for a resume and you bring this individual in. And I think when you bring someone in with a decent title, a big title, a nice compensation package, and give them authority, I think they feel they have to come in with all the answers. And in hindsight or looking back, I wish they would have came in with a few more questions. And I think I gave the interview process and we did a lot of things, but they didn't always understand the culture or the way I would have made decisions or different things. So we didn't have luck. So it took a couple of years of dealing with some, and I don't fault those people. Like I said, it was the whole process or maybe the way I went about trying to bring these people in. Maybe I didn't give it the time I should, but that really didn't work out. So when I was committed then, I didn't want to go to the outside anymore. And I wanted to try to find that person inside that I could mentor or groom from inside. So yeah, I was made the decision to do that.
So how did you select that person, or did you have a couple that you were sort of trying out?
Yeah, I think so. There was probably, that's a great way to put it, trying out. I had probably, you know, four or five individuals who were working here, and in our business in CNC machining manufacturing, you get on my radar by probably having skills and abilities. You know, you have the technical skills. You can machine, you can inspect parts, read blueprints. So you got to be technically sound. But I was looking for more than that. So a lot of times in companies, that's the person that does get promoted, and as they should. But I was really looking for someone, though, with more soft skills. I had to make sure they had the combination. They had to be strong technical ability, but I also wanted them, you know, to have self-awareness, empathy, be able to communicate, team build, have the ability to lead, and then also want to lead. And so I was looking for those. I was looking for the traits that you don't always, that aren't always the hard skills or that you can't always do, but that you want to be able to notice in people, you know, that maybe they think like an owner without being an owner, all those different things. I was looking for someone who could possess more of the soft side and the people side, emotional, intelligent type side of things. I was searching for that.
And that person or those people, when you started sort of trying them out, they probably had no idea what you were doing.
No, correct. It was almost business as usual. I was just paying maybe a little bit more attention to how they were responding to certain situations or different things that were going. So yeah, no. And I didn't want to make them aware or make it a competition or do that. I was working with them in certain areas. And then what would happen would be I would just, the person that I see who rose to the top or the forefront, I just started to work a little bit more exclusively with that individual. You know, just started to focus on growing them once I had made that decision. And that probably took, you know, I've been working with these guys for years as it was, but then probably another 6 months to make that decision, 6 or 8 months of working with individuals. And for a variety of reasons, some would fall to the wayside. They still worked for us, or they still, you know, still kept in their original roles, but I knew they would not be the one to grow with me in the role I was developing.
Yeah, and then probably, well, presumably by that approach, they didn't have any idea that, you know, they were being considered for something, so they didn't have to feel slighted or less than when they weren't selected.
Correct. And yeah. And I think as time went by, it became a little clear, or they knew then, as probably over a couple of years span, mm-hmm. they could start to see, they knew what had happened, and it just we did lose a few that way, or some even questioned or came in my office and talked about it, which I really appreciated. So. But some knew how it worked out, and some may not have, or they didn't really have that much concern about it, or maybe they knew they weren't the right person. Some voiced different concerns, but at the time, no. And then it became apparent over the years what I had done or what I was doing.
Yeah. So this grooming process, it's an investment in your time, and it's a financial investment as well. So how long did it actually take you to get it all figured out?
Figured out, we're probably still doing that. No, it was probably the whole deal took probably, you know, we're 10 years into this, you know, the working arrangement that I have with my, I call my right hand man, or my, you know, my second command. But prior to that, the heavy lifting was the first, you know, 1 to 3 years, you know, first couple of years as we started to do things. And I would just, you know, start with projects and have them do certain things. with that, then maybe take over certain, you know, maybe scheduling, and then a different area of the shop, and then whole departments, and then pretty soon the company itself. So I never really told them even what the outcome would be. I would just kind of say, you know, there's more opportunities here for you. There's some room for growth. And he really was dedicated, saw things through. Like I say, he became my go-to guy when things had to get done. So it took years, and I really wanted to give the time. I mean, the investment in the time was really what I didn't do in the past. But when I look back, it's what my grandfather and father did with me. And so I made sure he, you know, when they taught me, it wasn't just what we were doing and how we were doing it. It was why we did it as well. And so he knows how I'd feel about issues, the approach I would take. He probably knows how my dad or father or grandfather thought about things because I explained it in that kind of detail. The approach I took was really, let's say I'll use an example. We were going to visit a customer and we're going to get a work awarded. Well, if we were driving to that customer's plant, I would say, listen, here's this meeting. We've got this meeting scheduled. Here's what they're probably going to go over. They may ask for some, you know, price concessions. They may do this or that. We kind of just talk like a little pre-meeting, what we think would happen, what my responses would be, how I'd deal with it. Then we'd actually have the meeting. You know, we'd be on site at the customer and it'll all play out however it did. And then on the drive back, we kind of debrief or recap what happened and say, what could have been better? Did it really go the way we wanted? Yeah, they added this question. They didn't even ask about that, and kind of talk about it. And we still use that three-pronged approach to a lot of things. Whether he's doing employee reviews, we talk about, yeah, they're probably going to ask for this. You might want to talk about that. Here's their concern. Here's what we can do. You know, and so then he'd have the review. We'd have the actual thing would happen. Then we talk about it after. And I don't think people reflect enough on past decisions and outcomes. And I think that was important for us to better improve or to continuously improve by kind of, you know, weighing how things, situations worked out on the human side, on the personal side of things. So that was kind of how we dealt with it and over the years. And it took time. So it really took the years just to encounter enough business issues or situations that he would feel comfortable with. And one of the great skills that he had, I think he knew what he knew and then knew what he didn't know. And he would come to me when he didn't feel comfortable making a decision. And then once he became comfortable with making that decision, he could make it on his own. But it was really a great situation, a great way to grow somebody who I didn't want to give up. I wanted the company to grow. I wanted others to make decisions, but I didn't want to change the culture. And I didn't want it to be decisions I wouldn't make or operate in a manner I wouldn't be happy with it. That wasn't our mission, vision, and value. So I created, I don't want to say a mini version of me. It's not, he's different in certain regards. But he would know, he tries to run it the way I would run it. And he tries to make decisions based on what I would do. And that's how we approached it. And it took years to do that. And now pretty much we're working how we would normally do. So there's not really much more I'd add to him. Anything he'd have to learn now would be skills if I wasn't even going to be at the company, if I was going to leave or that. So I'm maximizing his skill set to the most, I think, utilizing him to the fullest at this point for what we're doing.
Tom Marini, the CEO at Marini Manufacturing, shared his story on the Make It Right podcast when he was my guest in mid-July. You can hear our full conversation on episode 61. We live in a world where the word innovation is everywhere. And on episode 63, I got a brand new perspective on what it could mean. People use the word innovation to describe incremental changes. But Dr. Adam Milofsky explained and proved that true innovation is much more than that.
You know, I always love when people talk about measuring results, right? And they measure patents or they measure, you know, all these little things, how many things went through some filtered process or some stage gate thing or God knows what. And we sit there and see, you know, there's only really one measure of successful innovation. And it's really, are you making any money? That's really it. If I go to a venture capital group and they're starting ventures, did they exit? Did they make money? Do we have revenue? Or are we doing it profitably? Do we have large margins? Are we transforming the way people live essentially in the end? So if it's a company, they're trying to make money. They're cutting costs, enhancing revenue, enhancing margins. If it's a person, we get a little simpler. And we think it actually applies to companies. And that's the nature of time. What do we all we wish we had more of? Either more time or better quality time or both. And when you look at an innovation, if you don't find yourself somehow improving the nature of time, more often than not by a pretty good order of magnitude, you're not innovating. You may want to say you're innovating, and it may sound good in a commercial or an ad or something like that. They sound good talking to investors, but the bottom line is you're probably doing something incremental. So for us, the way we measure things is just bottom line results. Because everything else, the problem with a process in and of itself versus, again, principles, is that the act of measuring things becomes the end, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we filed 350 patents this year. You know, we have 25 different startups. We have 62 different research and development programs. You know, we hired 52 more PhDs. None of those things gets to the bottom line, right? Because I could have thousands of patents like a lot of companies do, a lot of universities do, government institutions do, and not one of them was ever commercialized. They're just right in the proverbial heap or pile somewhere. And so we always tell folks, you know, what do you want to get out of this? And usually if it's the CEO, the board, the owner of the company, the investor, they're measuring it in only one way. Am I making money? Am I impacting companies or people's lives in such a way that that money I'm making will also persist for a long period of time? That simple.
Yeah. Wow, the fog just lifted. How did that happen? Yeah, that makes perfect sense, right? So tell me about some of the manufacturing challenges you've addressed with these approaches and what were your results?
Sure. I guess, you know, I'll start with a little one and then I'll start with a big one. But the little one in some ways is simpler and illustrative. And this goes back over 20 years, back into the mid-90s, 96, 97. And we had just formed ABM Associates. I was working with my dad and he got a call from a company called Diodario, and they make musical instrument strings. I believe they're the largest in the world. They're located out on Long Island. And they had essentially gotten a little form letter in the mail, and the little form letter was for the resins they use to make their strings. So musical instrument strings are a complex winding and held together with a resin. And as it turned out, you know, this I'm oversimplifying the story here, but the automotive industry used 99.9% of this stuff, decided they didn't need it. And so they got a form letter that said, you know, dear Diodario, we won't make this anymore. You're screwed.
Wow.
That's not fun. And obviously that wasn't the intent by the company making the stuff, right? But when we went in, and they basically just wanted something very straightforward. Can we get this? Can we get a new resin? Can we get something replaced? We got to get back online. And we only have 60, 90 days of stuff left or whatever. And we said, if you're going to put in all this effort to come up with something new, why don't we see where things went wrong, if you will, and what are the things, what are your fondest hopes and dreams for your company, right? What would be transformation? And they basically, you know, went through the laundry list. Well, first, we never want to be getting a form letter again for the resin we're buying. And we were like, well, what needs to be true for that to not happen? You need to own the formulation. You don't want to be dependent upon someone else's formulas. So we want to develop something for you. And so it's the reverse. You go to a company and have it made for you, right? That would solve one big issue and you'd never encounter that challenge ever again, in all likelihood. The other thing was, well, what do you want your strings to do? And one of the things was, is that, well, when they made strings way back when, you know, it was kind of a statistical hope what strings you got. So I'm not a music player by any stretch. But how the sound dampens, whether it dampens very quickly, whether it dampens very slowly, determines the kind of music you might play, right? A sharp note, I guess, versus a muddy note. And it was kind of random what they would get in the industry. So it wasn't just them, it was everyone. And we said, well, okay, so if you could maybe dampen in a controlled manner in 5-millisecond increments or something, that would be somewhat transformative to your industry and your manufacturing. They're like, yeah, okay. And we said, all right, well, we'll have to see what needs to be true to do that. The next one was, could you make stuff faster? Everyone wants to make things faster, right? And so we said, okay, you know, how does that work now? And they were like, look, you know, occasionally we can get up to 3 times faster than we do, but that's actually pretty rare. And so then we just basically sat down and walked through what we like to call an adaptive innovation, the what must be trues. And as it turned out, when we started to break up those what must be trues, you know, it turned out that if you went out there and you looked for materials that were good at dampening sound and that you could actually control the dampening, notice I said nothing about music there. we were able to go out and find places where that was true. And it turned out it was things like on grain sacks for shipping to keep them from vibrating and sliding all over a rail car, right? Found these materials, how the products were designed, adapted them to what they were already doing for musical instrument strings, and all of a sudden they could basically tune in any dampening that they so desired on command. Simultaneously, through the cure mechanism we developed for them, we ended up in a situation where we were able to triple or more their production, all right, basically overnight. You know, we were able to switch to a cure mechanism that didn't rely on energy-intensive systems and materials that could fail. And so we transformed basically their business, right? It only allowed them to become ever more dominant than they were before. If I fast forward to Cirrus or Bioformix, the company we sold a couple of years ago, which was probably the biggest effort we'd ever done, we actually attracted over $1 trillion in annual revenue, partners, investors, prospects, and customers, from people like Apple to Procter & Gamble to General Motors, who was our largest strategic. There we were looking at bigger challenges, and the bigger challenges really was a test of adaptive innovation, was if we had a big global challenge, could we actually solve it? And could we do it in a timely manner that was effective? And in this case, we looked at energy. And as it turned out, there was this big ball of fire called the sun. And one way or another, energy did get here to the earth. And one way or another, it could be harvested. So whether you burn things or had solar panels or wind or whatever, you know what? It really wasn't a crisis. It was just a matter of the form. And so we kind of walked away from that. But the other one that was interesting was essentially petrochemicals. And there was this fear that, you know, 10, 12 years ago still, that they might run out. I don't know that that's really the case anymore, because you can get them from plants and all kinds of other things. That's all changing. But a corollary to that was, could we eliminate energy between the two there? Energy from manufacturing. Could I paint a car and not use heat? Could I do 3D printing and not use light? Right? Because if I didn't have to use heat, if I didn't have to put in energy, I could probably do things much faster, much more efficiently. But even more importantly, I could use a much wider variety of materials. So if I use heat, I'm kind of limited, right? If the thing's going to melt, if the thing's going to burn, then heat isn't very good for you. As it turned out, we kind of prescribed all the what must be trues. And after about 3 years, we stumbled upon, pretty literally, through some other work we were doing, a chemistry that had been looked at for 150 years. But couldn't be reduced to practice for any number of reasons. But that essentially the polymers, the materials could be formed ambiently at room temperature, kind of like super glue, cure nearly instantaneously. Ethylene malonates, they're called. And yet simultaneously, we could infinitely vary the properties, TGs of 300 degrees C to minus 70 C. So in other words, something really hard, powerful, strong, all the way down to something super rubbery and elastomeric, and do it on command and do it on demand. In the end, we were able to prescribe all the what must be trues to solve technical problems that hadn't been solved in 150 years. We're able to solve the basic tenets of them within about 6 months. All right. The initial target, we were able to solve in only about a month. And that was pretty staggering. And I got to say again, it wasn't because I'm brilliant or any of the group that we were working together that we were brilliant. My wife always tells me I'm an idiot, kind of clueless. But because we asked the right questions, framed in the right context, and then looked around for where things had been solved before. And we ended up with a technology that in the end, for someone like GM, being pursued with BASF now, that's a public thing, we can paint a car standing still in less than 9 minutes with no heat, no solvent, no nothing.
Wow.
It fundamentally will change the way all things can be manufactured forever in ways that are far more transformative than simply something like additive manufacturing or different types of cure mechanisms. We fundamentally targeted and changed how things were made based upon what would be transformative. And that, to be honest with you, was very exciting. Because it really proved out what we had spent 3 or 4 years before, kind of perfecting what adaptive innovation was, looking not only at what we were doing, because that was minor, but looking at what people like Thomas Edison had done, all the way through to Steve Jobs. What's common between those two folks is the simple fact that they looked at the business model, the ecosystem, the world around them, defined what needed to be true to achieve a transformation. And then they went around looking for it. So Edison didn't find 10 or invent 10,000 ways or whatever it is to make a light bulb. That isn't what he did at all. Instead, what Edison did was he had a list of specifications, not just technical, but from a business standpoint, from a labor standpoint, from an end user and consumer standpoint. And he tried 10,000 ways till he find the one that made the most sense, where he had existing labor pools, didn't have to train anyone, could use existing manufacturing methods, could provide a safe and easy-to-use set of materials, where he could transform lights instead of having kerosene and Rockefeller and burning down buildings, on and on and on. And that's what made Edison brilliant. And when you fast forward to Jobs, you look at the iPod, all he was doing, well, he made a lot of money, was seeing just how little information could someone be provided with other than a few tactile buttons and run a device intuitively. And that eventually became things like the iPad and everything we have today, right? Really true brilliance from that standpoint. And he just looked around for everything that would allow him to meet those what must be truths. And so for us, those are some really key principles that end up surrounding innovation that I'm sure we can talk about later.
That's Dr. Adam Malofsky, a partner at Elements, where he and his colleagues use adaptive innovation and transformative innovation to bring about seemingly impossible results for their clients. He shared some really interesting stories on episode 63. The Make It Right podcast was incredibly fortunate in the summer of 2019 to have amazing guests who kindly took the time to share their stories and insights with us. Kevin Snook and I thank them and you for participating in this weekly manufacturing journey. That's our show for this week. You can find the Make It Right podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. And also, please follow us at Make It Right Pod on Twitter and at Make It Right on LinkedIn. And please share us with your friends and colleagues. If you'd like to align your manufacturing process and get the most out of your team and machines, check out Kevin Snook's book, Make It Right, which is available through Amazon. I'm Janet Eastman, and thanks very much for listening. Until next week, keep making it right.